Shall we turn in our Bibles now to Genesis chapter 7? God saw that the wickedness of the earth was great. The imagination of man's hearts was wicked continually. Men were involved in Satanism. Unnatural sex. Violence, corruption. And so God decided to bring an end to that scene of iniquity. And God destroyed the earth that then was with the flood of waters. But God saw Noah, a righteous man. And so God commanded Noah to build an ark. The dimensions of it would equal approximately those of the Titanic. 450 feet long, 75 feet wide. And to bring into the ark the various animals, two of each species, with the exception of those animals which were considered clean. There were to be seven, probably pairs, of each of those animals. And so Noah followed the instructions of the Lord. He prepared the ark. And so that gets us then to chapter 7. Chapter 6 ends with, "Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did." Then the Lord said to Noah, "Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation." Interesting things here. First of all, notice the Lord didn't say, "Go into the ark." He said, "Come into the ark." So God, it would seem, was in the ark inviting Noah to come on in. The Lord is with us. And how glorious it is to have the Lord with us, especially in the storms of life. And come on in, the Lord said. Inviting him into that place of protection, the place of surviving that great Holocaust that is to come. And so God invites us, come on in to the ark, the place of safety, the place of refuge that God has prepared that we might survive in the great flood of evil, the flood of judgment that is going to come against the evil. Secondly, the Lord said, "Because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation." God saw him as righteous, even as God sees us as righteous. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't do any unrighteous deeds. Would to God I didn't, but I do. I am a sinner. I am not righteous in and of myself. But God sees me as righteous, and that's what really counts. It's how God sees me. And God sees you as righteous as you believe and trust in Jesus Christ. And so this is that righteousness of God that is imputed to us because of our faith. This is the righteousness of God that was imputed to Noah because he believed God and obeyed God. And because of his belief and obedience, by faith, Noah built the ark by which he escaped the destruction of the flood with his family. And so through his faith in God, God saw him as righteous. "I have seen," God said, "that you are righteous." It doesn't mean that Noah, was a perfect man, had not done any evil. It means that he believed and trusted and obeyed God. Of course, his faith in God was evidenced by his obedience, which is always true. If you say you have faith in God and yet you don't obey God, then, your words of faith are discounted. But he obeyed God to prove his faith, and thus God saw him as righteous, even as God sees us. I love that. As righteous. Before me in this generation. Now here he was living in the midst of an evil generation, a corrupt generation. And yet the Lord saw him as righteous. And so you shall take with you 7 each of every clean animal, male with his female. 2 each of the animals that are unclean, a male and his female. So God is preserving this species. Again, as we pointed out last week, the ark that he built had sufficient volume to hold 2 of each species, plus enough food that they could survive for the little over a year's time that they spent in the ark. They could have put 522 livestock railroad cars into the ark. If you figure out the volumetric measure within the ark, the size of it, could have held 522 of these livestock, or what they called cattle cars on the trains. 125,000 lambs, but they only had 7 pair. And so the ark was sufficient. 7 of each kind of birds, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. Now, of course, he didn't have to take an aquarium into the ark. The fish could all survive the flood. And those birds that, like ducks and the type of birds that are able to, be in the water, they did not necessarily have to come in. For after 7 more days, the Lord said, I will cause it to rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all the living things that I have made. So now we get one of these many sevens that we'll be coming across. 7, of course, is a number that is symbolic and meaningful in Scripture, the number of completeness. 40 is a number of judgment, if you're interested in numeric structures and in numeric equivalents, etc. 40 is the number of judgment. So it will rain 40 days and 40 nights. And I'll destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. He was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. So Noah with his sons, his wife, his sons' wives, went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. And of the clean beasts, and of the beasts that are unclean, of birds, of everything that creeps on the earth, 2 by 2 they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. The 600th year of Noah's life, in the 2nd month, the 17th day of the month. On that day, all of the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. So now, in one verse, he describes the method by which God brought the flood upon the earth. And notice, it wasn't just the rain, but the great fountains of the deep were opened up. Now, before the flood came, there were rivers. We read that there was the river that went forth out of the Garden of Eden, and it went out into 4 different directions, the Hiddekel and the Tigris and the Euphrates and so forth. The question is, how can you have rivers if you don't have rain? Because prior to the flood, there was no rain. So evidently, there were tremendous underground reservoirs of water, which are called here fountains of the deep, creating artesian-type types of wells. Now, it could be that there was a whole series of underground caverns, sluices. And it could be that the heat of the earth would even, if necessary, distill the waters of the seas as they would flow into these caverns and be heated and distilled, and God could have had a whole vast irrigation system under the surface of the earth that sprung forth and flowed as rivers. These vast reservoirs of water that God had placed under the earth were broken up, the fountains of the deep. As well as that vast canopy of water that God had suspended in space. In Genesis chapter 1, where he divided the waters above the firmament from the waters below the firmament. And that vast ocean of water that God had suspended in space that was a canopy to protect the earth from much of the cosmic radiation, shielded the earth, caused the earth to be like a green garden, actually, all over the earth. Without the poles being iced, with this water suspended in the atmosphere, you would not have had any violent storms, you would not have had any violent winds. There would be only a slow movement of air. And with the tremendous humidity and moisture and the warmth that had been universally warm, you would have had, of course, an ideal climate to grow plants and for the just the earth to be totally verdant. Interesting. We have discovered great charcoal beds under the ice at the South Pole region, which means there had to be at one time vast forests down there. Mammoths with tropical vegetation have been found in Siberia, there in the frozen tundra area, which indicates again that was once a tropical paradise. But with the emptying of the water, the canopy of water. Now, this is the only way that you could explain rain for 40 days. No matter how full the clouds may be of water, and we have had times when, you know, maybe it rained for 2 weeks or something, but for 40 days for the deluge to continue on a worldwide basis means there was that emptying of that vast canopy of water that God had suspended in space. We'll get to it in a moment, but there's also the very great possibility that at this time there was a dramatic polar axis shift. It is very possible that prior to the flood, there were no large mountain regions such as we have today. It's quite possible that all they had prior to the flood were rolling hills. We don't know anything about the geology of the earth prior to the flood. It was indicated in the scripture that the land mass was all together and that the seas were all together. There was just the one land mass and the one ocean of water. It could be that there were tremendous cataclysmic catastrophes that took place at the time of the flood beside just the breaking up of the deep and the emptying of the canopy of water that had been suspended in the atmosphere. It could be at this time the earth was even moved slightly out of its orbit around the sun. For there are indications in our text, and we'll come to it in a little bit, that at this time, before the flood, there was only a 360-day year. And we know that after the flood, there were 365 and a quarter days to the year. But there's evidence here that the years before the flood were only 360-day years, perfect cycle, 360, the perfect circle. And so there are also possibilities, and there is some evidence, that it was at this point that the earth became tilted on its axis. That tilt of 23 and a third degrees, which gives us the seasons, did not take place until the time of the flood. So the combined polar axis shift, the tilt of the earth, and the changing of its orbit could have been produced by the close pass of a huge asteroid, or even the impact of the earth by a huge asteroid, upsetting the whole balance of the system. Wielichowski, in his book Worlds in Collision, suggests that it was at this time that the planet Venus made its first pass into the solar system, made a very close pass to the earth. Close enough that it upset the whole balance of the earth, and that there was the gigantic electrical spark that stopped the earth in its axis and then caused it to begin to spin in the other direction. And he points out a lot of evidence that shows that the earth may have at one time rotated in the opposite direction on its axis. All interesting speculation. What we do know is that God emptied the canopy above the earth of that shield, that water blanket, and that God opened up the great fountains of the deep. Now, as the waters began to cover the earth and the pressure of the water began to come over the land mass, the weight of the water probably broke through the earth's crust in many areas, causing it to collapse. And at this time, great canyons were formed, and the water, of course, would go into the canyons. And through the downward pressure, there came the upthrust. And so you find the coastal range of mountains, our high Sierras here in California, thrust up from the weight of the water that was pushing down there in our shoreline here. And tremendous geological upheavals as the result of the water changing its base, its bed. And we have tremendous evidence around the earth from the fossils and all, where up in the Himalayas, 20,000 feet, fossils of sea life. So the thrusting up of these mountains as the weight of the water was moved around, and you can imagine the whole upheaval that took place upon the earth at this time and the geological changes. All this was going on during this period of a year. Actually, there were 40 days where the rain was descending, but the activity continued long after the rain had descended as the weight of the waters began to push down and break the earth's crust, and all of these changes were going on for close to a year's time. And the rain was on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and on the very same day, Noah and Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's wife, the three wives of his son with him, entered into the ark. And there were every beast after its kind, all the cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, every bird after its kind, every bird of every sort. I don't know if you ever think about these things, but, you know, there were a lot of problems. sanitary and otherwise, no doubt, within the ark, with all of the animals that were there. However, it is quite possible. Now, you know, we're dealing with God who can do anything. And we do know that bears have the capacity of hibernating. And it could be that God gave that same capacity to these animals for this special occasion. And that they all went into a hibernation process like the bear does, where he, you know, just goes in and he lies down and he just waits out the winter. In a cave someplace or in a log someplace. He just, you know, snuggles in and waits out the winter, hibernating, doesn't eat, and just sleeps the whole while, you know, during this process. So there was little activity. It could be that the ark wasn't nearly as noisy as you imagined it to be with all of the animals, the bears and everything else that was in it, you know. So they went into the ark two by two. I think by this time you get the idea that I believe that this story actually happened, that this is a real event that God is chronicling for us here. And I do. I have no reason to doubt the veracity of God's word. In fact, I think that this universal flood is a far more plausible explanation of the geological column than is the evolutionary hypothesis. This model is much easier to accept as we look at the geological column and takes less faith than it does to believe in evolution. So they went into the ark. And all those that entered, male and female, the Lord shut him in. And so, I think that that is significant too. God said, come on in. They went in, and then the Lord shut them in. The flood was upon the earth for 40 days. The waters increased, lifted up the ark. It rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed, greatly increased on the earth. The ark moved about the surface of the waters. The waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth. All the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. But they probably, as I said, weren't that high at that time. Actually, if the earth were completely flat, if we didn't have these great canyons in the oceans, if the earth was totally flat, it'd be covered by 6,000 feet of water. So the mountains didn't have to be that high. God just lifted up a land mass on the first day of creation and lifted the land mass out of the waters. But he didn't have to lift it that high. It was only after the flood that we had these huge. And if you'll study the evidence, the Andes, the Himalayas, the high Sierras even, geologically, they all testify of not having existed very long. In fact, in the Andes, high up into the Andes, we have the terraces of the farms that go far beyond the timberline. In fact, they go right on up into the glacier ice. And it's impossible that the Indians could have farmed that area if it were at that altitude that it is today. And so there is evidence that that thing has been thrust up in the last 5,000 years or so. And very strong evidence. And again, Earth's in Upheaval, an interesting book that will lead you down that fascinating path of possibilities. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward. That is probably 15 cubits above the highest point of the land mass at that time. The mountains were covered. And all of the flesh died that moved on the earth. Birds and cattle, beasts, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, every man. all in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. So the dry land creatures. He also destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing, bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth, only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. That is, the earth was covered with water for the 150 days. During this time now, of course, you've got all of this water on the earth. Now, how do you get rid of the water? So again, you see, it took the upthrust of these mountains and all to get rid of the water off the face of the earth. The water is still here. It didn't just evaporate. It doesn't just run off like it does now into the ocean. We may have a localized flood situation. And it may get, you know, water everywhere, but it ultimately runs off and is into the ocean, where again it evaporates and is carried by the clouds over the landmass, and we get the water cycle. But with all of this extra water, everything being covered, there had to be then these upthrust of mountains. And so the geological changes were taking place during the 150 days and probably even longer. Then God remembered Noah. Now, that isn't to say that God forgot Noah and suddenly remembered, hey, I got a guy floating around down there, you know. But that activity of God, direct activity of God with him began again. You see, one of the problems that we have with God is that we don't have divine terms by which to describe him. Now, there are probably terms that when we get to heaven, we'll discover and we'll understand, but we couldn't even understand them now because they are terms that define the aspects of an infinite God. So you see, in our describing God, we are limited to our vocabularies. We have to describe him with words of our own vocabularies, and thus we use human terms to describe the characteristics of an infinite God, because that's all we have to deal with. So when God begins his activity with Noah once again, the word God remembered Noah, that is, he began again to directly intervene and guide him in his activities at this point. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep, the windows of heaven were also stopped. The rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters receded continually from the earth. And at the end of 150 days, the waters decreased, so that the ark came to a rest on the seventh month, and the 17th day of the month on the mountains of Ararat. The ark rested. Now, it is interesting to me that God would take care to give us the very days that the things happened. And God doesn't just capriciously throw in dates. There no doubt is a significance to these dates. In the 600th year of Noah's life, the second month, the 17th day of the month. And so the Bible gives us the very day, probably beginning with creation, that the flood began. Now, God gives to us the very day, and notice this is a period of 5 months. But we are also told that it's 150 days. It's now the 17th day of the seventh month. It began on the 17th day of the second month. Now on the 17th day of the seventh month, 5 months, but it's 150 days. And so it is a year that is calculated on a 360-day year. 5 months times 30, you get your 150 days, so you've got a 360-day year by which the calculations are made. And it is interesting that in the Old Testament, up until the time of Daniel, the years are still calculated to the Babylonian calendar, which at the time of Daniel was still a 360-day year calendar. And so here we have 5 months, 150 days, so you have your 360-day year calendar. Now, the interesting thing, the seventh month, the 17th day of the month. The exact day. Do you know what day it was that Jesus rose from the dead? It was on the 17th day of the seventh month. The month of April. Jewish calendar, the seventh month, because it begins in October. And on the 17th day, you see, the Passover takes place on the 14th day. Jesus was 3 days and three nights in the earth, and so it was on the 17th day of the seventh month that Jesus rose from the dead. It was on that day that the ark rested. Interesting, and we pointed out before, Noah's name means rest. So rest rested in the ark on the 17th day of the seventh month. And the waters decreased, and it rested the sea. And the ark rested in the seventh month, 17th day, on the mountains of Ararat. Now, there have been a lot of stories as to the location of Mount Ararat. A lot of different countries have laid claim to having Ararat within the country. However, it would seem that the location in Armenia is probably the correct location. And there have been reported sightings of the ark on Mount Ararat, which of course is now in Turkey, in as much as they conquered Armenia. And there have been reported sightings of the ark throughout history. Marco Polo even records in his records of the ark being a sort of curiosity piece and visited many times by the people living in the area of Mount Ararat. And so there are those who believe that the ark still exists there today. There was a book written by a French explorer, Navarro, who wrote the book, The Ark, I Touched It, and he brought down certain pieces of wood from the top of Ararat, which he said he broke off from the ark. There have been, of late, every summer, expeditions that have gone to Turkey attempting again to locate the ark. Jim Irwin, who was one of the astronauts who went to the moon, has put together an expedition the last two summers of group of men. Heritage College in San Diego has sent expeditions for the last 3 or 4 years searching for the ark. Men with scientific equipment and gear hoping to find the ark and to bring back the actual evidence that the ark does still exist. And the descriptions of it, of course, are quite fascinating. But as yet, there is no real solid confirmation that the ark does indeed still exist, encased in ice, about the Ararat is 17,000 feet. They say it's about the 15,000 foot level. Now, if they do discover the ark, it of course would be one of the greatest archaeological discoveries in the history of the world. Therefore, it is worth looking for. And it would be extremely fascinating. But would it make you more of a believer in God if they finally found that thing up there? Would that cement your faith? Wow, I guess so. No. If they don't believe Jesus said the record of Moses, they wouldn't believe it even if a man came back from the dead. Your faith in God is a matter of choice. And there is sufficient evidence already to cause us to believe in God. And the waters decreased until the 10th month. The 10th month, the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. That is probably some of the lower hills. So it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. He sent out a raven which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had abated from the face of the ground. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot. She returned into the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand, took her in, drew her into the ark to himself. And he waited for another 7 days, sent the dove out again, and the dove came back with the freshly plucked olive leaf. And so we see the picture of the dove with the olive leaf, and it's become a symbol of peace. And Noah knew that the waters had abated from the earth. So he waited another 7 days, sent out the dove again. This time it did not return. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from the earth. But Noah removed the covering of the ark, looked out, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. So 360 plus the extra 10 days, it happened on the 17th day. This is the 27th day. God said to Noah, go out of the ark, you and your wife, your sons' wives with you. Bring out every living thing. So 371 days or so, they're in the ark, and now they come out, and God commands them, be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. So Noah went out, and every beast and creeping thing, according to their species, went out of the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered a burnt offering on the altar. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. So, interestingly, the first thing that Noah did was to build an altar unto the Lord and offer a sacrifice. It was a burnt offering sacrifice, which is the sacrifice of consecration. Now, this all happened, you remember, long before the Mosaic Law, the Levitical Law. Before God instituted the various types of sacrifices or codified the various types of sacrifices, before God had ever codified the clean and unclean animals. Yet there was something that there was already that awareness. Moses just put it down and God codified it through Moses, but it was something that already pre-existed before Moses. The idea of a burnt offering sacrifice, the sacrifice of consecration unto God, the idea of the clean animals, which were defined and described under the Mosaic Law, but already known and understood long before the Mosaic Law. Now, Noah, having descended from Adam, had a sinful nature. God recognizes and acknowledges now the sinful nature of man. But even though man does have the sinful nature, God is going to make a way of redemption for sinful man. Recognizing that man's nature is sinful, that he has this tendency towards evil, there is within the very nature of man that tendency towards evil, that sinful nature. Yet God declared that he will not destroy every living thing again as he had done. That is, by the waters of a flood, God is going, the judgment that has come during the time of Jesus Christ will not be a total judgment and extermination of all that are upon the earth. There is a indication in the scripture that the judgment that will take place just prior to the return of Jesus will destroy two-thirds of the earth's inhabitants, that he'll bring one-third through. So it won't be a total extermination as it was in Noah's day of those outside of the ark. Even there will be that possibility that a person could survive through the great tribulation period. It's not a possibility that I would personally want to gamble on. And so God made his covenant then with Noah. God promised him, while the earth remains, there will be seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night shall not cease. Quite possible that they didn't have winter and summer prior to the flood. That there was just a uniform temperature around the earth annually. I mean, it was just, you know, beautiful tropical climate everywhere all year long. But now the earth tilted at the 23 and a third degrees, giving us longer and shorter exposures to the direct rays of the sun. As we make our orbit around the sun tilted, it gives us the summer and winter, and it, of course, have also caused the polar ice caps. Because of the long period without the sun at the North Pole during our winter months and at the South Pole during our summer months, form these huge ice caps on the poles, which account for the winds and the storms and the violent movement of the air currents, which of course, makes much of the earth uninhabitable now. The vast areas of the North Arctic Circle areas that are for the most part uninhabitable by man. These began to exist only after the flood. So this is one of those subtle indications that more than just the breaking up of the fountains of the deep, more than just the emptying of the canopy of water, there were probably other great catastrophes that were associated with this time of the flood of Noah, creating the elongated year, 365 days now, and creating the various seasons of winter and summer, cold and heat, seed time and harvest, day and night. Now, this was God's covenant with Noah. God promised this was going to be. And up to the present day, God has kept his promise. I told you it was going to get dark. And I had every confidence when I told you this morning it was going to get dark this evening. Because I have God's promise. It's going to be day and night. And I can promise you it's going to get light in the morning. And I have no qualms about turning out to be a false promise. Prophet, I mean. If in the morning it stays dark and the sun doesn't come up and the things just stays like it is now, tomorrow morning, then you can say, hey, he's a false prophet. And God broke his promise. You can say, wow, God broke his promise. No, as long as the earth remains. Now, the earth isn't going to remain forever. Heaven and earth is going to pass away, Jesus said. But as long as the earth does remain, we're going to have our seasons, we're going to have our orbit around the sun, we're going to have our diurnal processes, we're going to have the day and night, we're going to have seed time and harvest, we're going to have heat and cold. Those things are going to exist as long as the earth remains. Now, a lot of interesting speculation can be entered into at this point. I believe that when Jesus comes again to establish his kingdom, that in the great tribulation period, when a lot of the cataclysmic judgments of God are taking place, they are twofold. They are one to judge the people upon the earth, but they are also to bring the earth back into its condition that existed prior to the flood and the judgment of the flood. So that I believe that in the kingdom age, you'll have conditions existing much as they did before the flood, where again you'll have ideal climates universal here on the earth. In other words, I do believe that the Arctic pole areas again will be beautiful, gorgeous jungles, tropical jungles, and beautiful areas to explore. And I believe that the earth will be probably corrected in its present tilt, and God will probably just put it again straight so that we get the same exposure to the sun from both poles all the time. The polar caps will melt. Of course, there will be geographical and geological changes. A lot of the islands are going to disappear during the great judgment of God that is coming upon the earth. There, mountains will disappear. There will be new ocean floors. And I think God's going to sort of restore things back to the way they were before the flood, where the earth will just provide an ideal environment for man. You won't have to go to Hawaii. But everywhere you go will just be beautiful, lush paradise. With the waterfalls. Remember, the Bible talks about the deserts will break forth and blossom like a rose, and there will be streams in the deserts, rivers in dry places. And God speaks of a whole process that is going to take change during the kingdom age when Jesus is reigning upon the earth. And so it'll be an earth that is restored to the glory and the beauty of Eden, the glory and the beauty of the earth prior to its destruction by the flood during this kingdom age. If you're interested in a scientific kind of a treatment of the flood, I highly recommend the book by Henry Morris and John Wickham, The Genesis Flood. It's a scientific treatment of this whole cataclysm that took place. And I think that you would find it, you that have that certain bent or ilk, I would suggest it. I would also suggest to you, though they do not come from a biblical base, the two books of Emmanuel Velikovsky, Worlds in Collisions and Earths in Upheaval, where he presents just a tremendous amount of evidence that support a universal flood. And as I say, he does not come from a biblical base, but his research is just outstanding. May the Lord be with you, and may the hand of God rest upon your life. And may you find your place of rest in Jesus Christ, our refuge from the coming storm. May the Lord deal with you concerning your own commitment to Him, and cause us not to just think of God in a take it or leave it kind of a mode, but that of complete and full surrender and commitment unto Him. Days are short while the earth remains, but the earth isn't going to remain much longer. And thus may we, as Peter exhorts, begin to live and look towards the things of the Spirit, knowing that the material earth is to be destroyed. May we place our values in the things of the Spirit, our investments in the things of the Spirit, that they might be lasting and survive. May God just really direct your life in a very special way this week as you walk in fellowship with Him. And through the grace of Jesus Christ, may God see you as righteous before Him in all the earth. In Jesus' name.